Shenandoah to popular spot like Enchanted Rock State Natural Area? If so, consider low-budget private campgrounds, which can be found on sites such as Hip Camp. Like an Airbnb for the outdoors, Hip Camp features for-profit campsites across the country, including more than 300 in Texas, where landowners welcome visitors to their Instagram-friendly personal oases. Rates are usually modest, and properties range from 2 acres to more than 50. The terrain, views, and experiences vary widely. Need running water? A flushable toilet? Better double-check the amenities. Hip Camp also includes small cabins, Airstream trailers, and, yes, tree houses and yurts if those are more your style. Most allow a limited number of guests at a time, ideal for social distancing. Private campgrounds aren't unique to Hip Camp, of course, but the site makes it easy to find what you're looking for. Here are three options not far from popular state parks. Low Gear Farmstead near Menard. When you arrive at this plucky organic farm on the Edwards Plateau, the terrain might seem a little forbidding. Thorny mesquite scrub and prickly pear abound. Gear Gillespie, who runs the operation with his wife, Logan Bell, will probably greet you at the front gate in a pair of knee-high snake boots. However, just past the old home place where Bell's great-grandparents once lived, a rutted trail suddenly descends into a lush world straight out of a fairy tale. Here, tall grass grows in the shade of acres of majestic pecan trees, all of it nestled in rich bottomlands along the spring-fed San Saba River. During a reunion with several old friends in the summer of 2019, we pitched our tents, lounged around a fire pit, and floated the lazy San Saba in tubes we brought from home. The composting toilets in the outhouses remind us that we were pretty far off the grid. The property has no showers or picnic tables, although Gillespie helpfully loaned us his charcoal grill. Because we were paying such a low rate, we weren't about to complain about the Spartan amenities. Bell says she keeps costs to a minimum so folks at all income levels can afford to visit her family's farmstead. I love that everyone can appreciate the beauty and magic when you pull into that rolling pecan grove, she says. There are three campsites for up to 6 people, $20 a night, close to South Llano River State Park, about 44 miles away. Then there's Seco Ridge Campground in Utopia. Woody Golden, a sculptor and former art instructor at the University of Houston, wants to make and sell his own beer, so he built a small brewery on the hillside Utopia property he owns with his wife, Elaine. There's just one problem. The tiny town is in a dry area of Uvalde County where alcohol sales aren't allowed right now. So the Goldens joined Hip Camp last fall, opening their 42 acres of old-growth cedar to tent campers, glampers with a king bed and a cargo tent, and people looking for unique lodging, a tasteful bunkhouse converted from an old shipping container. Visitors share a centrally located open-air kitchen and a bathroom with hot showers, but the primitive campsite scattered throughout the property can provide more privacy and seclusion than your typical park campground. Everybody can go their separate ways when they camp here, says Woody. Place also offers a treehouse for children to play in, disc golf, and an easy hike to sweeping views of the hill country. And unlike at state parks where the consumption of alcohol is against the rules, he doesn't mind when his guests imbibe. Everybody who's come through has been very considerate and respectful, he says. 7 campsites at $30 a night, glamping tent is $50, and the bunkhouse with a queen bed and a bunk bed is $75. It's close to Garner State Park, about 17 miles, and Lost Maple State Natural Area, about 19 miles away. Then there's the Honey Hole, Point Blank, Texas. Just about 6 miles west of Lake Livingston in East Texas, empty nesters Robin and Steve Bumbera offer primitive camping on 15 acres of oaks and tall pines. Light breezes sweep down from the rolling hills and ripple across a 4-acre pond where campers can swim, float on tubes, or fish for largemouth bass and panfish. Water's really nice because it's so clear, Robin says. It's not your typical pond. It's the only bad part of the fishing. The fish can see you. And they're like, nope, I'm not falling for that. There's also a covered pavilion with a propane-powered kitchen, a hammock stretched between 2 pine trees, patio chairs encircling a fire ring, and an outhouse with a composting toilet. Another bonus, campers can choose where to pitch their tents. People are more than welcome to camp in the woods, Robin says. Once they see the pond, they really want to stay close to the water. There's 3 campsites for up to 4 people, $45 a night. It's close to Huntsville State Park, about 29 miles away. Next up, still in state, we're going to go to food and drink. This is Recollections, by Mimi Swartz. Column this month entitled, Lubies, Luann Platters, and Me. Time had a way of stopping when we dined at the iconic cafeteria chain. Not any longer. On a rainy Sunday in May, after Governor Abbott allowed restaurants to reopen at limited capacity and before the subsequent surge in coronavirus cases, my husband, John, and I knew just where we needed to go. We had a craving for something predictable and close to our hearts, Luby's Cafeteria. We grabbed our masks and headed to our neighborhood Luby's first, but it was still closed, the parking lot forlornly damp and vacant. Some quick Googling got us driving about 20 minutes in the opposite direction, northwest up US 290 to one of the few Luby's locations in Houston that promised an open door. We're almost beside ourselves. It had been about 3 months since I had enjoyed a roast chicken Luann platter. In pre-coronavirus days, I had one every couple of weeks, at a minimum. If you're not a fan of this ubiquitous Texas-based chain, the previous paragraph probably strikes you as ludicrous, some quarantine-induced fever dream. And you probably don't care, either, that Luby's has been on the ropes since Houston-based Pappas Restaurants bought a majority stake in the company in 2001, tried to upgrade in multiple ways, al dente green beans, and then got stuck in a nasty proxy fight over, among other things, a debt load that now hovers around $35 million. It fell to the Houston Chronicle to deliver the bad news on June 3rd, not long after we ventured out for that first meal. The economic disaster caused by the virus has the Pappas family looking for a buyer for Luby's. Assets, including real estate, are on the block, and Pappas has closed several of its other properties in Houston, including a Papado Seafood Kitchen and a Pappas Shrimp Shack. It's possible a new owner will come along and keep some of the cafeterias going, but it's not looking good. One thing I have learned about beloved restaurants over the years is that when they are gone, leaving behind a deeply personal emptiness that can never be assuaged by another menu from another place. Threadgills and Shady Grove in Austin, both casualties of the pandemic. Baby Ruth in Dallas, those jalapeno polenta croutons. The current location of Liberty Bar in San Antonio is nice, but makes me pine for the tilting wood frame structure on Josephine Street I made a beeline for whenever I went back to my hometown. And I still crave the sweet, glistening eggplant caponata at Joe Matranga's long-closed eponymous spaghetti joint in North Houston. The owner, a former wrestler who was middle-aged and bulky by the time I met him, gave out after-dinner postcards of himself as a buff, loincloth-wearing hunk with a spear through his chest. Marcel Proust would have understood that it's not exactly about the food, but the larger memory the food triggers. I was young there. I had all the time in the world. Yeah, whatever happened to... Okay, but Luby's? Comfort food in its blandest possible form? I know. For decades, our friends have found our loyalty to the chain a constant opportunity for derision. Almost 30 years ago, I tried to convince a dear friend, the estimable food writer Allison Cook, that she should come with us, that Luby's food was actually really good. The look on her face, some warring combination of tolerance, pity, and massive self-control, persuaded me never to invite her again. Little sidebar here. End of the line. Luby's, founded in San Antonio in 1947, has 76 cafeterias across Texas. If the chain disappears, fans can console themselves with its 2006 cookbook, Luby's Recipes and Memories, which is very heavy on the mayo. Back to the text. But I wasn't deterred. John and I started going to Luby's around 1991, as soon as our son Sam was old enough to sit in a high chair. That was another period of being semi-housebound, albeit a much happier one. There was a Luby's within a couple of miles of us then, and often when John walked in from a long day of work, I would not very nicely demand to get out of the house. Everyone who is now stuck at home and caring for a toddler knows what I'm talking about. That moment when you know that if you look in the mirror, you will see wild-eyed Elsa Lanchester and Bride of Frankenstein looking back. But I also knew that if we could just get to Luby's, all would be well. Some cheerful, uniformed waiter would meet us and tie a balloon to Sam's rolling wooden high chair and help him choose between red and blue Jell-O. No, I did not care what was in it. Then that same server might wheel Sam to the table while I got lost in all the comfort food choices I never made at home. mashed potatoes and brown gravy, broccoli and cheese, chicken fried steak. Maybe we would run into some neighbors in the same boat and have a communal dinner that left the floor around us littered with crumbs and spilled milk. I didn't have to clean up, and dinner for three cost less than the cheapest entree at a better restaurant. Who could resist? Somehow, even as Sam grew up and away, John and I never quit Luby's. We made friends with some of the employees. Crescencia, who loved to fuss over Semolito, was our favorite and couldn't resist a chorus of line servers who, even as we aged, asked, "What you gonna have, baby?" Our Luby's was located right between the nexus of Montrose and River Oaks and the old Fourth Ward, so it always had an eclectic crowd of straight and gay, rich and poor, old and young, black and white, and just about everybody else you could imagine, including Houston cops and down-in-the-luck types who had scraped together enough money for dinner and dessert. John and I even found ourselves there on election night 2018 when the early returns hinted that Beto O'Rourke might actually beat Ted Cruz. Everyone watched the results on one of the wall-mounted TVs, one for each of the four walls of the restaurant, joking around until we were driven out by the 8 p.m. closing time. We'd spend an evening with a lot of people with whom we had little in common but our humanity, and we'd all managed to survive. Over the years, I've sometimes left Luby's feeling sad, but I've never left felt hopeless. And so it was when we got in line at Luby's in May. The location wasn't as cheerful as our usual spot. The interior was darkening, owing to fewer windows and the rain, and the beet and cucumber salads were packaged for takeout instead of dished up fresh. There were fewer entree offerings. No hulking roast beef ready for slicing under the neon red heat lamps. And across from the serving line was a COVID-19 prevention array of paper towels and hand sanitizers for sale. Still, there were enough similarities to get me through. I got my roast chicken luan platter with corn and spinach, along with a cucumber salad. My husband got his chopped steak topped with bacon and greasy cheddar cheese, cooked to order as they didn't have any waiting on a steam table, with corn and pinto beans for its two sides. We split a piece of jalapeno cornbread in celebration. Smallish crowd provided a masked sampling of Houston's diversity, socially distant at far apart tables, but still amiable. Our server looked after us like we were guests at her daughter's wedding. "Did we need anything else?" she asked us. "Well, yes, but for now, if not forever, lunch at Luby's was enough." A little sidebar here to our recollections is taco of the month. It's a pick-me-up, sweet picadillo and a corn tortilla makes everything better. The restaurant is Taco Stop, location 1900 Irving Boulevard in Dallas, and it's the picadillo taco. A Taco Stop taco is a culinary mood booster. After one bite, it's difficult not to believe that maybe, just maybe, the day will be a good one. This is especially true if the walk-up taqueria's daily special happens to be the picadillo taco, juicy but not greasy. The finely ground beef studded with diced potatoes and carrots is wrapped in one of the city's best corn tortillas. Flour is also an option, which come from Dallas's small, family-owned Areza tortilla factory. Corn fragrance that lingers on your hands has the same calming effect as essential oil emanating from a diffuser. "I've always been interested in seeing what could help make everybody's life a little better," says owner Emilia Flores, a native of Durango, Mexico, who was a practicing psychologist before opening the taqueria in the Design District in 2011. There are a lot of ways of doing that. One of them was obviously my professional practice, and another one is food. I think in most cultures, but particularly for Mexicans, it's a nurturing thing. That little sidebar was written by Jose R. Relat. We turn next to one of our feature articles. This is entitled Twilight of the Bronze Age by Stephen Harrigan. As statues of slaveholders, Confederate soldiers, and Texas Rangers come tumbling down across the state, those of us who treasure historical sculptures are being forced to reconsider what should be honored, what should be commemorated, and what it's time to let go of. Statues, the best of them, have a puzzling power. They cast a spell of stillness. Placid, unassertive way, a bronze figure stands there, gazing out at some middle distance, creates an illusion that it has assumed control of the space around it. That's why it's odd to watch a statue come down, either in the heat of passion, with people prying it loose with ropes and chains and crowbars, or in the much more orderly way, the long-standing Texas Ranger statue at Dallas's Love Field was removed and carted away one morning this June. You can watch the process on a sped-up video that was posted on the internet afterward. The 8-foot-tall statue, dedicated in 1961 as the Texas Ranger of today, depicts an idealized lawman striding toward what we assume to be a restive crowd, his right hand ready to draw the gun in his holster, his left hand raised slightly in a gesture signaling a plea for calmness and reason. In the video, a city work crew in yellow t-shirts and hard hats bustles around the statue in the airport's main lobby, installing straps under its shoulders and unfastening it from the granite base incised with the law enforcement agency's semi-official, semi-apocryphal motto, "One Riot, One Ranger." The airport, in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic, has a sepulchral emptiness. There are few witnesses, of whom the least aware is the statue itself. As the ranger is hoisted up off his base into the air and a swarm of workers sets him down onto a dolly cart and rolls him away, he appears eerily compliant, a bystander to his own exile. He's not alone, nor will he be. We're living in a time of convulsive reconsideration over what should be valued and what should be honored, which monuments to our country's imperfect past can be deemed fit to remain. In 2015, two works by the Italian-born but eminently Texas sculptor Pompeo Coppini, statues of Woodrow Wilson and Confederate President Jefferson Davis, were removed from the South Mall at the University of Texas at Austin campus and hauled away on a flatbed trailer. Statues were part of an eclectic verging on random grouping that had lined the mall for more than 80 years, and that most UT students had likely passed by for decades between classes without ever looking at or thinking about. Those who did care about them were likely to be people who found their presence insulting and enraging and wanted them gone. For black students in particular, these heroic likenesses of figures like Davis or his generals Robert E. Lee and Albert Sidney Johnston represented a stinging provocation. It was a provocation so familiar to UT history professor Dana Ramey Berry, the author of books on slavery and the history of black women, that when she arrived on campus in 2010, her first reaction to seeing the statues was more puzzlement than offense. Not surprised to see a statue celebrating a Confederate general. There are so many of them, she told me. But she couldn't quite figure out why these particular statues were there, since their subjects had tenuous connections at best to UT, or in some cases, even to the state of Texas. She would discover, as a member of a university task force that was created in 2015 to advise what should be done with the statues, that those isolated figures on the South Mall were the remnants of Coppini's dream of a grand sculptural statement. In his mind, the completed work would symbolize the reunification of the United States after the Civil War and the perpetual flowing of American patriotism and American enlightenment. But his vision of a harmonious grouping of great men unraveled. He and Major George Littlefield, the Confederate veteran and UT regent who funded the commission, had a falling out that led to the university reconceiving the whole project and leaving it, to use Coppini's word, dismembered. Late on a Sunday night in August of 2017, about a week after the Unite the Right protest in Charlottesville, Virginia, had turned ugly and deadly, the four remaining statues on the mall, Lee, Johnston, Confederate Postmaster John H. Reagan, and Texas Governor James Hogg, were removed. The Jefferson Davis statue eventually reappeared as a cautionary exhibit at UT's Dolph Briscoe Center for American History. The statue of Hogg, a more or less progressive 19th century governor who didn't quite belong in what had come to be seen as a rogue gallery of white supremacy, was removed because it would have looked weird standing there alone among all those naked pedestals. It was eventually relocated elsewhere on campus, but the rest of the grouping was sent into storage limbo. A few weeks after Coppini's statues came down, an equestrian bronze of Robert E. Lee by Alexander Themister Proctor that had been the centerpiece of Lee Park in Dallas since 1936 was removed by city work crews, sold at auction to an Edison lawyer for $1.4 million, and later re-erected on the putting green of a La Jitas golf course. People thought of stone as ageless, muses the sculptor hero of my 2011 novel, Remember Ben Clayton. But nothing lasted as long as bronze. Nothing stood so strong against the tide of time. That's what my fictional sculptor, Francis Gil Gillaney, desperately wants to believe. But near the beginning of the book, one of his statues, to his mind the most enduring, is destroyed by rioters during the red summer of 1919, when racial animus flared up all across the country into lethal unrest. His statue is of a Plains Indian. It has no direct relevance to the events at hand. A white mob's determination to lynch a black man accused of rape and held prisoner in a courthouse. But to a crowd consumed by all-purpose racial hatred, there's no distinction. In the book, Gil pleads with the mob and even tries to fight them off, but he can't prevent them from prying the statue off its base and attacking it with sledgehammers. They're going to pound it into bits, and there was nothing he could do. Just a pile of metal that had been defaced and seized by a mob of no more concern to them than the windows they were smashing or the building they had set aflame, just a piece of junk that its creator had tried haplessly to defend. As my character discovers in the novel, and as our society has made clear over the past few years, bronze is not an immutable metal after all. It can't stand up to the erosion of old values or the rise of new ones. Just like everything else, it has an expiration date. I love statues. They're the first things I seek out in a new city, the things I return to again and again in a familiar one. I love their eerie verisimilitude and the way they command their surroundings as if nature itself, rather than long-dead kubas, had decreed them into being. I'm haunted as only a non-artist can be by the mystery of how a great sculptor can precisely recreate faces and forms in a way that suggests both profound silence and brimming animation. And I deeply respond to the way that, like ancient ruins or still standing buildings from another human era, a statue can burst through the fabric of present time and stand before you as an artifact from a world that once was. An unholy world, much of it, when you look at our nation's history through an honest lens, and in the wake of the killing of George Floyd, that lens has become crystal sharp. When the conversation about pulling down Confederate monuments began to heat up a few years ago, my instinctive response was that the solution to the problem lay in more statues, not fewer. Leave the Confederates in place as a historical demonstration of what Texas had once chosen to honor, but fill in the landscape with bronze testaments to people whose humanity had been sidelined or whose stories had been suppressed. Robert E. Lee would still be mounted on Traveler in Lee Park, recently renamed Turtle Creek Park, but it would have to share Texas with black Reconstruction leaders like George Ruby or Matthew Gaines, Tejano heroes like Jose Antonio Navarro or Jovita Idar, female disruptors of the status quo like Minnie Fisher Cunningham or Bessie Coleman, and indigenous resistance leaders like Quanah Parker or Setanta. But this sort of conceptualize our history but don't erase its solution was the autoimmune response of someone who had grown up with the luxury of regarding statues as neutral works of art and not as chronic taunts. Week upon week of tumultuous racial reckoning in our cities had begun to make what I thought was an eminently reasonable argument sound defensive and feeble. It was one thing to be aware of the outrage black people might feel living in the shadow of a towering monument to a man who fought to enslave their ancestors. It was another thing to be made aware of it night after night on television and in the streets of my own city, and to be prodded by conscience to choose sides in a personal war between my aesthetic preoccupations and an age-old injustice I had never been forced to experience. When it came to Confederate statues, there was a point at which standing up for history felt too much like standing in the way of it. To me, Dana Barry told me, taking down statues means we are now ready to move on and usher in change, to usher in a new mindset. When the Berlin Wall came down, that was a significant moment in history. What we're experiencing right now with the recent unrest is likewise a flashpoint in history. And we're at a pretty good natural spot to break here. Remind you, you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight into Sound Broadcasting. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight into Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight into Sound Radio since 1967. Back to our text. The Texas Ranger statue at Love Field was not a Confederate monument. It did not commemorate a time when Texas seceded from the United States and fought a war against it to preserve, as the state made clear in its Declaration of Causes Against the Union, the servitude of the African to the white race. It was, if you took it simply on the terms of its own presentation, a salute to the sort of temperate law enforcement our society is now clamoring to achieve. Ranger was alone and exposed, not wedged in ranks behind a riot shield. He had a cowboy hat instead of a helmet, a holstered pistol instead of tear gas canisters and flashbang grenades. What you noticed most about the statue was his calming hand. But the legacy of the Rangers is far more complex than the statue implied. Its title, Texas Ranger of Today, may have been an attempt to put some distance between the shiny new decade of the 60s and the dark but not especially distant past in which Rangers had casually murdered Tejanos and Mexicans along the Rio Grande border or been deployed as the enforcement arm of segregation. Indeed, the model for the statue had been a Texas Ranger captain named E.J. J. Banks, who had appeared in Mansfield in 1956 to keep order during an attempt to integrate the local high school. His way of keeping order had nothing to do with protecting the black students who were trying to enroll. It was to intimidate them into giving up. The statue wasn't of Banks. It was just its model. But the associations were close enough, and the historical echoes were deep and disturbing. There have been calls for the statue to come down dating back to at least 1992, but the publicity surrounding Doug J. Swanson's recent book, Cult of Glory, whose dust jacket promised a 21st century reckoning with the Texas Ranger legacy, pointedly including atrocities, brutality, oppression, and corruption, convinced the officials at Love Field that the time had come. So the Ranger came off his pedestal and was wheeled away. There was another legacy behind the statue, that of the sculptor, Waldine Couch. In this feverish moment of accounting, when monuments are falling all across the country and the world, maybe we can spare a thought for artists like her, whose ambitions were bright, whose efforts were mighty, but whose works ended up being overrun by history. Couch was 18 years old, bird thin and 5 feet tall when she boarded a train in 1910 from her hometown of Brady to travel to San Antonio. The women of the Brady Tuesday Club had noticed her incipient talent and arranged and paid for her to study under Pompeo Coppini and to live with the sculptor and his wife, Lizzie. Couch came from a family in turmoil. Her father was a failed photographer with a drinking problem. Her unstable mother once attempted to kill herself in front of her daughter by slashing her own throat with a butcher knife. In Coppini, Couch encountered an imperious and controlling teacher who thought women didn't have the physical strength or the artistic conviction to be monumental sculptors. He was wrong about her. While other girls dreamed of boys, she remembered, I envisioned my statues in parks and plazas. She won Coppini over by enduring his demanding, dismissive assessments of her work and surprised him by proving herself capable of the grunt work that went into the creation of larger-than-life-size statues. Assembly of massive armatures out of scrap lumber and pipe, the endless sorcerer's apprentice-style lugging of heavy buckets of the wet clay used to model the figures. Over time, they became colleagues and collaborators, and Coppini grew so fond of Couch and so regally possessive of her that he tried to adopt her, to the outrage of her still-living parents. In the end, she became a foster daughter to the childless Coppinis, inherited their home and studio when they died, and upon her death in 1986, was interred between them at the foot of the elaborate bas-relief tombstone that the great sculptor designed for himself in San Antonio's Sunset Memorial Park. Her career did not turn out to be quite as expansive or imposing as her mentors, but several of her works, like the looming statue of Moses Austin in front of San Antonio City Hall, and especially Love Field's Texas Ranger, became part of the background visuals of urban Texas. Her first public commission, installed in San Antonio in 1914 when she was 22, was a bas-relief drinking fountain on the Commerce Street Bridge called the First Inhabitant that depicts a Native American holding bowls of life-giving water in each hand. It's still there more than a century later, no longer an active drinking fountain, and probably rarely remarked upon by the pedestrians who stroll in front of it every day, but who still feel an uneasy absence if it were to disappear. Papini was a model for my novel's fictional sculptor, Frances Gillaney, and Couch, Papini's foster daughter, helped inspire the daughter I invented for my protagonist. I even gave her a public commission called Spirit of the Waters that I placed on the same spot where First Inhabitant stands. Couch was also the first monumental sculptor I ever met. I interviewed her in 1984 for an article I was writing for this magazine about Papini. We met at the Maestro's former studio in San Antonio, which by then had turned into the Papini Academy of Fine Arts, of which Waldine Couch was president emeritus. She was 92, almost blind, cordial but direct. My focus was on the man who had guided and commandeered so much of her career, but I wish now I'd thought to widen the lens of the story and ask her more questions about her own life. Sculpture was something inside him, she told me about Papini, a remark that was defining of her own life as well. He loved it with all his heart and soul. It's hard for me to imagine the pain she would have felt to know that her signature work, The Texas Ranger, would one day be so out of phase with the times that it could no longer stand. Well, maybe it's not that hard. I'm not a sculptor, but almost 30 years ago, long before statues began coming down in this country, I helped start a group that was determined to put them up. We called ourselves CAST, C-A-S-T, a consciously imprecise acronym for Capital Area Statues Incorporated. This all came about because my friend, the author and journalist Lawrence Wright, who shared my unfashionable fondness for statues, decided to start a nonprofit group to rectify what he considered the paucity and stodginess of Austin's sculptural landscape. Derry even had an idea for our first project, a statue of three old white men jabbering on a rock. It was to be a depiction of the old guard of Texas letters, J. Frank Doby, Roy Benedict, and Walter Prescott Webb, who used to congregate at Austin's Barton Springs for an alfresco literary salon around a half-submerged boulder. Somehow, the little group we put together managed to convince a celebrated sculptor, the late Glenna Goodacre, to take a chance on us. And somehow we managed to raise the money to pay her and to watch in awe one November day in 1994 as a flatbed truck carrying the statue we called Philosopher's Rock arrived from the foundry in New Mexico. Some years after that, we erected another statue on Congress Avenue in the heart of downtown Austin. The subject was Angelina Eberle, the innkeeper heroine of the 1842 Archive War, who had shot off a cannon to prevent men sent by Sam Houston, the president of the Republic of Texas, from confiscating the government archives, which would have effectively moved the capital of the infant nation from Austin to the president's namesake town on Buffalo Bayou. Sculptor was the renowned editorial cartoonist Patrick Oliphant, and in his trademark style, he depicted Eberle firing off a full-size cannon in a mood of comic berserkness. Long after that, we average about one statue a decade. We commissioned Cleet Shields to create an 8-foot-high bronze testament to Willie Nelson that was unveiled accidentally, we swear, at 4:20 p.m. on 4:20 at 2nd Street in Lavaca in front of Willie himself on a horizonless downtown sea of his fans. We were aware that the subjects of these statues were imperfect human beings. Webb, the fully clothed historian who stands at the edge of Philosopher's Rock, frozen in discussion with Doby and Bedichek in their bathing suits, has long been under fire for his 1935 book, The Texas Rangers, something of a paean that paid scant attention to pernicious racism that is an ineradicable part of the organization's history. And Eberle, during at least one point in her career as an innkeeper, had run her business with enslaved labor. But we were unwilling to sacrifice the themes of these statues to the flaws of their subjects. We were proud that Philosopher's Rock was not a celebration of a general or a war. It was a monument to friendship and conversation. Angelina Eberle was a monument to an outraged woman of courage and decisiveness. The Willie Nelson statue was a monument Willie, being a part-time statue impresario gave me a taste of the satisfaction sculptors must feel when, after months or years of research, physical labor, and uncertainty, they finally watch a crane lift the final product onto a place where it is envisioned to remain for all time. Among the members of our little cast group were writers, filmmakers, photographers, and musicians, and all of us agreed that imagining a statue and seeing it at last in its two-ton reality was the biggest creative buzz we had ever experienced. I still get a secret thrill out of watching passersby read the plaque on Angelina Everly's statue, "My words in bronze," and of seeing young children ignoring the signs, asking them not to climb onto the philosopher's rock and settling themselves into the laps of those grandfatherly figures. But I know that behind every statue we erect and the story we mean to tell with it, there will always be the dark shadows of another story, more palpable to some than to others. That's true of any work of art, but especially of public monuments, which must live or die by the consent of the populace. After confessing my entanglement with public sculpture to Dana Berry, who, by the way, is a fellow of the Walter Prescott Webb Chair in History, I mused aloud that maybe the words that appear on the Angelina Eberly and Philosopher Rock plaques, words that were carefully considered at the time and expensively cast in bronze, should undergo some revision so that they pointed out Eberly's slaveholding and the fact that when Dobie, Betacek, and Webb were holding forth at Barton Springs, they were doing so in an Edenic setting that was off limits to swimmers and philosophers of color. I think people would appreciate that, she said. Like you, I know statues can be beautiful works of art, but people need to have the whole portrait. My biggest issue is that there's only one side of a story. It's never the complete story. It's fine to celebrate people, but I think we should talk about their whole history and all their complexities, even if it's the stuff that makes us uncomfortable. There is no such thing as heavy metal permanence, as Pompeo Capini would find out to his horror if he were still alive. His statue of Sol Ross, Texas governor and Confederate general, who's long stood at the center campus at Texas A&M University, where he was once the president, has been sprayed this summer with graffiti, crowned with a rainbow wig, and made the focal point of heated protests, most notably featuring famed A&M sprinter Infinite Tucker. "I don't like the way I feel, knowing that statue is still around," Tucker said. Copini's Spirit of Sacrifice, a 60-foot-high monument that is better known as the Alamo Cenotaph, is caught in a crossfire amid all the competing constituencies involved in the ongoing transformation of the Alamo site. And back in May, it was sprayed with graffiti denouncing white supremacy, profit over people, and the Alamo itself. In late July, I drove to Victoria to have a look at another of Capini's imperiled works, a Confederate monument titled The Last Stand, which depicts in the sculptor's words a hero standing after a hard battle, wounded at the edge of a cliff. Local chapter of the United Daughters of the Confederacy, who funded the statue, greeted its unveiling in 1912 with rapturous approval. "The Confederate veterans will weep at the sight of it," their chairman wrote, "and every Yankee will weep at the sight of it." There was now a movement afoot in Victoria to remove the statue from its commanding setting in De Leon Plaza and relocate it to Evergreen Cemetery, where it could rest away from the public view among the Confederate dead. There was as yet no formal petition and no vote planned, but at a city council meeting the day I was in town, local citizens were given an opportunity to weigh in on the issue. The meeting, like so many during the pandemic, was being held on Zoom, so there was no point in dropping by City Hall. When I watched the meeting on my computer the next day, it was sometimes hard to make out what exactly was being said due to the accidental mutings and glitchy Wi-Fi. But the overarching argument was clear enough. For 108 years, an advocate for a removal argued, "This statue has been a reminder of Confederate values and ideologies. It were taken down," she said, "the empty space where it had once been would be a reminder that our community rejects hate and ignorance." The speaker who followed countered that the removal initiative was part of a Marxist uprising. "Let's get one thing clear," he said. "The agenda of the left has been exposed, and patriots from coast to coast and intrastate are wide awake." While the city council meeting was going on in real time, there was a simultaneous demonstration taking place at the statue itself, where several dozen protesters who were members of or had ties to groups like Texans Standing for Freedom, Texas Crossroads Civil Defense Force, Patriots for Texas, Lavaca County Incident Response Regiment, and This Is Texas Freedom Force had gathered in front of Capini's last stand. With their assault rifles and body armor, they looked like they were ready to make a last stand themselves. A demonstrator who said his name was Pyro introduced me to a stocky, muscular man who went by Hog. The main reason we're here is to protect our history, Hog, no relation to the former governor, said. Like all of the heavily armed men around him, he was disconcertingly friendly and polite, blithely indifferent to the pandemic, but understanding of my wish not to shake hands with him and stand 6 feet away. He was wearing a black T-shirt, camouflage pants, and level 4 body armor with steel plates front and back, and was carrying a collapsible steel baton, a Mossberg 500 shotgun, and a gruesome machete-like knife. I met a woman, he went on, who told me that they traveled to the United States and her children were homeschooled and they learned history by the monuments. And I don't see why this statue would cause any problems for anybody. Christy Marins, who was a leader of one of the groups at the demonstration, but who was not armed or decked out in paramilitary gear, said that the statue was a symbol of the great man that died fighting for history, and it has nothing to do with any kind of race or political stance. You cannot erase our history. I agreed on her with this much. You can't erase history. But you can melt bronze at 1,742 degrees Fahrenheit. You can break a statue into pieces, remove it, erect it somewhere else, replace it with something or someone more palatable to its time. That process is history, too. These thoughts had been on my mind when, several weeks before that visit to Victoria, I went to the Texas State Capitol to take what I thought might be a last look at some of Pompeo Capini's most imposing work. June 14th, 19 days after George Floyd's death, and street protests were still at high tide. Capitol grounds were closed, and National Guard troops were gathered protectively around the base of the biggest of the three Lost Cause memorials Capini created. This showpiece is the 1903 Confederate Soldiers Monument, which features representative figures from the Confederate infantry, cavalry, and artillery, Navy, and is crowned with yet another Capini version of Jefferson Davis. My view from behind the fence that surrounds the Capitol grounds was obscured by tree foliage, so I couldn't get a good look at Capini's other work. His superbly crafted equestrian statue of a Terry's Texas Ranger and the figure of a Confederate soldier that sits high atop a granite shaft honoring Hood's Texas Brigade. They are included, along with the Confederate Soldier's Monument, in a list of works that a group of state Democratic lawmakers have recently announced they want removed. Though the trees were in the way of several of Capini's sculptures, I did have a clear view of another installation, a much newer one. Only a few yards away from the main Confederate monument is the Texas African American History Memorial, which was unveiled in 2016. The work of Ed Dwight, it represents in one sweeping panorama the black experience in Texas, from Esteban, the enslaved participant in a 1528 Spanish expedition who became one of the great explorers in American history, to Bernard Harris Jr., first black astronaut to walk in space. As I stood there with my binoculars on the other side of the Capitol fence trying to read the plaques and identify the last relief faces of prominent black leaders, it seemed to me that part of the power of this new monument came from its proximity to the old one. From the way the story on the Capitol grounds flowed from suppression to triumph, that if the Confederate monument disappeared, the dramatic tension between these two historical polarities would be severed. Maybe that will be the case. Maybe not. As a white American who possibly admires statues too much and questions them too little, I realize that the times have not appointed me as the arbiter of what should stay and what should go. And I don't have an answer anyway. Except to urge that, in making these decisions, we at least recognize that some of these statues, like Capini's Terry's Texas Ranger Monument, which is alive with the kinetic energy of horse and rider, are works of art. If it's time for them to come down, it should be done with all the public ceremony that once attended their unveiling. And as works of art and totems of their time, they should still be allowed, somehow, to exist. There are already efforts by groups like United Daughters of the Confederacy and the Sons of Confederate Veterans to buy back public statues and place them on private property. My own preference is for outdoor museums. It would be not misty memorials to the losing side of the Civil War, but places where all these unwelcome statues could be erected on their pedestals so that the artist's original perspective, a crucial element in appreciating them, could be maintained. There was something hollow about the Texas Ranger statue being removed from Love Field with such indifferent efficiency, or with the grouping at UT being taken down in the middle of the night with no one to witness it. These were missed opportunities, the surrender to an indifferent bureaucracy of what should have been the public's business. The removal of a statue, its de-unveiling, calls for speeches, music, a solemn display of pride or dissent, a recognition that monuments are an expression of their time, and so are we. I know it's a naive fantasy to imagine the members of the Texas Crossroads Civil Defense Force standing there mournfully but peacefully next to the activists of Black Lives Matter as they say goodbye to not just a statue, but a monument to a time that we think is dead, but whose neurons are still firing into the present. But I imagine it anyway. That's a kind of exit, if it has to come, that I would wish for Pompeo Capini, Waldine Tausch, and the fictional Francis Gillaney, who all charted the course of their lives and careers on the impossible prospect that creations would be everlastingly admired. We're going to turn back now to the Willie Nelson special edition of Texas Monthly that come out this month, and we're going to turn back to the 10 best Willie Nelson albums of all time, and we're going to get back with number 6. This was Yesterday's Wine. We did 10 through 7 last week. Now we're doing a few more. Come out on Columbia Records in 1975. Yesterday's Wine is the first inkling of Cosmic Willie. The album's opening is bizarre, with his longtime drummer Paul English as the voice of God saying, "You do know why you're here," and an unidentified Willie replying, "Yes." Perfect Man has visited Earth already, and his voice was heard. The voice of Imperfect Man must now be made manifest, and I have been selected as the most likely candidate. Yesterday's Wine is Willie's most Christian album, packing a spiritual depth not found on most country gospel albums, even though there's no overt proselytizing. On original compositions such as It's Not For Me to Understand, A Blind Boy Parable, and Family Bible, a nostalgic look at Willie's religious upbringing, which he sold to his old friend Paul Buskirk and singer Claude Gray for $100 in 1959, only to watch Gray have a number 7 hit with it a year later, Willie poses the big questions about why life goes the way it does. The answer is the same each time. Have faith. Everything is in the hands of the Lord. I'm born. Can you use me? Willie Nelson was asking himself a lot of questions in 1971. For all his success as a songwriter, the 38-year-old hadn't broken through as a recording artist, but he wasn't asking for divine intervention. Instead, he was writing the questions down and turning them into lyrics for one long song, as he would later describe Yesterday's Wine. And he was ready to take a chance with them in the studio. Record is filled out with songs that would sound unrelated and secular in any other context. There are croons about the passage of time, Summer of Roses, and December Day that recall Frank Sinatra. And there are two trippy two-steppers pushed by a sliding steel guitar, the title track, and Me and Paul, an autobiographical account of his adventures with English, Willie's first outlaw reveal on record. But as part of Willie's heady concept, the songs tell a story of one man striving to understand exactly who he is, whose faith in God is giving him faith in himself. And if country music fans didn't get it, Yesterday's Wine failed to make the charts. Would soon enough. That was written by Joe Nick Petoskey. Next up, number 5, Shotgun Willie on Atlantic Records in 1973. When Kris Kristofferson heard the words Shotgun Willie for the first time, he called them mind farts. And given the context, the lyrics must have felt scattershotted, if not outright lazy. It had taken Willie 39 years, a move from Nashville to Austin, and a change of record labels to gain a meaningful amount of creative control. And when he finally got it, the man who wrote Crazy opened his post-Nashville career with Shotgun Willie sits around in his underwear. But however it sounded to Kristofferson in 1973, Shotgun Willie's first track now feels like a deliberate example of a prime Willieism. Taking horseshit and making lemonade. Willie began the 70s with a divorce, a house fire, and a multi-gun shootout with his daughter's abusive husband. He also happened to get dropped by his longtime label, RCA. But that was good news. It meant that he was a free agent living in Austin, when legendary Atlantic Records talent scout Jerry Wexler came nosing around looking for outsider acts to sign to the label's new country division. In late 1972, Wexler and Willie came to terms. But in February 1973, when Willie flew to New York to record at Atlantic Studios, he still hadn't written any new songs. In Manhattan, he sat on a Holiday Inn toilet and considered some of the recent bad times, the writer's block, the Shotgun Willie nickname he'd earned from friends after the shootout, and wrote down some lyrics on the envelope of a sanitary napkin. Sitting around in his boxers, he began the most exhilarating left turn in country music history. Shotgun Willie is a big part of the origin story of the musical moment known as Redneck Rock. The album came out the same year as Jerry Jeff Walker's Viva Terlingua and Waylon Jennings' Honky Tonk Heroes, and it sold more copies in the state capital than Willie's previous records had nationwide. But if Shotgun Willie sits near the center of outlaw country's lore, country and rock, rednecks and hippies, together! It's also a killer R&B record. Backed by the Memphis Horns on Shotgun Willie, a Motown bass line on Whiskey River, and a Meters-esque drum groove on Devil in a Sleeping Bag, Willie casts a net far beyond Central Texas. Here, he uses his creative freedom to combine old personality traits, honky-tonk crier, sneaky jazz man, blue-eyed soul man, folky stoner, into a new persona. Just listen to Whiskey River. In Willie's hands, a Johnny Bush tune becomes a slow-burning punk song, a two-step, a comedy of self-deprecation, and a tragedy of self-harm. Even if he'd always contained multitudes, Shotgun Willie recast them into a single image. Few people get cooler at 39, but when the album came out, fans started calling him Shotgun Willie. Soon he'd be famous enough that one name would do. Max Marshall wrote that. Turned out number four. Album entitled Then I Wrote. Was on Liberty Records, 1962. Imagine for a moment you're Willie Nelson. Here's 1961. After years of scraping by in various locales on your gift for making heartaches and memories rhyme, you're finally in Nashville and tasting success. Country stars like Farron Young and Patsy Cline are having huge hits with your songs. Royalty checks are coming in. Fat ones, and for the first time in your life, you got some real money. But you're not satisfied. These songs are your essence, and you want to sing them. You want people to know they poured out of your soul. So you sign with Liberty Records, a second-tier country label, the one willing to take a chance on you. The next fall, you put out your first full-length album, calling it And Then I Wrote. But the humble title is a feint. It's maybe the most accomplished debut album in history. For many of us born in the six decades since, it's impossible to imagine a world in which these songs didn't exist. If you grew up in Texas, they were likely just about everywhere. Ball games, cookouts, weddings and funerals, road trips, radio, and every jukebox you've ever flipped through. Not just the songs that ascended to the country canon, such as Hello Walls, Funny How Time Slips Away, and Crazy, which appear back to back to back on side one, but the deep cuts like Mr. Record Man, Undo the Right, and Wait Me When It's Over. And Then I Wrote isn't just one of the greatest debuts of all time, it's one of the best singer-songwriter records ever recorded. Not that it sounds like one, as that term is understood now. That is, like many of Willie's early albums, a Nashville sound record, though the sheen is mercifully dialed down. It was produced by Joe Allison, the head of Liberty's country division, who kept Willie's idiosyncratic vocals out front, dropping the glossy choruses into the back of the mix and eschewing strings altogether. While that may have worked for posterity, it didn't for country fans. Willie's voice and phrasing sounded alien, and his lyrics were just weird. He speaks to walls and windows on Hello Walls. On Darkness on the Face of the Earth, he channels poet Pablo Neruda to describe a breakup in cosmic terms. The stars fell out of heaven and the moon could not be found. The sun was in a million pieces scattered all around. Though the album produced one top 10 single, Touch Me, none of its other three singles made the charts, nor did the album itself, which is almost funny now. If And Then I Wrote were released today, people would mistake it for a greatest hits record. But even among so many classics, Crazy is on another level. It's equal parts George Gershwin and Hank Williams, a swaying, sophisticated melody with dumb, simple lyrics. I'm crazy for trying and crazy for crying, and I'm crazy for loving you. Cline released her definitive version in 1961. It has been ranked the number two jukebox song in history. And in the years since, it's been recorded by dozens of artists, from Linda Ronstadt to Chaka Khan to Austin emo band Mineral to, for the first time on this record, Willie himself. song that would take him from poet-maker to a composer worthy of inclusion in the Great American Songbook. And this little one was written by Christian Walk.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas community update.
H-E-B and Favor Delivery have introduced a new service that allows customers to have grocery essentials delivered to their doorstep in 2 hours or less. In addition to H-E-B curbside and home delivery, shoppers can use Favor's new Express Delivery service. With Express Delivery, customers can choose up to 25 items from a selected list of groceries. For more information, go to newsroom.heb.com.
Each week, hear an hour of informative news and reports. First, it's the AARP Report, with readings from AARP Magazine and the AARP Bulletin. AARP publications cover stories that include health, lifestyle, celebrity biographies, and senior employment issues. Then it's diabetic news, with readings from Diabetes Magazine, Diabetes Self-Management, and more. Hear the hour-long block of the AARP Report and Diabetic News, Thursdays at 4 a.m. and 10 a.m., and Sundays at 6 p.m. from Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 80 with haze. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-60s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 80s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McLamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight into Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the September issue of Texas Highways, and I'll start out with The Power of Richard Linklater's Nostalgia. The famed director's forthcoming Apollo 10 and a Half, a movie about growing up in 1960s Houston, takes him places he's never been before. By Michael J. Mooney. On one side of the warehouse-sized room, a 2.5-story green wall towers over the soundstage. Attached to that wall is another shorter wall, also painted the distinctive green screen green. A large swath of the floor in front of the walls is the same color, creating a seamless field of infinite green so pristine that most of the crew wears soft blue booties over their shoes to avoid scuffing it. There are at least 40 people in the room this morning, each responsible for and focused on something different, all weaving and buzzing around a line of cameras, monitors, cranes, and various bright white lights. At the center of it all, wearing a loose gray button-down shirt with the sleeves rolled up, a relaxed pair of Levi's, and black Nikes with red laces, is the director, Richard Linklater. Once the actors are in place, the clapboard snaps, and the room gets quiet. Linklater nods. "All right," he says in a firm yet calm voice. "Action." It's late February, on the ground floor of Troublemaker Studios in East Austin. But for the purposes of the movie being made, the space is supposed to be the suburban sprawl of Houston in 1969. In the middle of the green soundstage sits an immaculate classic white Chrysler sedan, a whale of a vehicle with an old Texas license plate. It's parked next to a standalone drive-in movie speaker. In the front seat of that car, a couple in their late teens is dressed head to toe in attire taken directly from photos from the 1960s. His orange-striped shirt and slicked-down hair, her light cotton dress and dangling ponytail. In the scene being filmed, the couple makes out, while two pre-adolescent boys pretend to sneak up and spy on them. After a few seconds, Linklater stops the boys, walks in front of the cameras, and points at various markers on the green floor. "You walk through a car," the director says, matter-of-factly. His calm, urban Texas drawl makes some of his instruction sound a little like spiritual guidance. "Remember to stay in your lane," Linklater tells the boys. The boys go back to their original marks and walk toward the Chrysler again, this time careful to maneuver around the designated imaginary cars in the imaginary drive-in movie theater. The boys point and giggle at the kissing couple in the car. The director lets the cameras run, encouraging the actors to do whatever feels natural to them in the moment, which is his general approach to directing. There's more giggling. The movie being filmed, slated for release on Netflix in 2021, is called Apollo 10 and a Half, a space adventure. It will be Linklater's 22nd feature film, and like much of his previous work, he wrote it himself, and it's largely autobiographical. The movie is a novelistic look at the life of a 10-year-old boy growing up in Houston in the late 1960s, just as NASA was sending humans to the moon. But, unlike any of Linklater's other films, the entire movie was shot on green screen. The actors will all be rotoscoped, a dreamlike computer animation style Linklater employed in his movies Waking Life and A Scanner Darkly. The backgrounds and settings, the drive-in movie theater and the scene with the Chrysler, for example, will be filled in with 3D computer illustrations using decades-old photos and home movies as reference. These images were compiled by the production staff, and some were even submitted by the public. But beneath all of that, the huge crew and the technical challenges, is a director guiding actors on camera. "Let's do it again," Linklater says. He's so relaxed, it's almost like he's suggesting a restaurant for dinner. This time, Linklater gives the boys another direction, as they creep toward the kissing teenagers in the car, to bring them into a certain moment and place in history. You're happy to be here, too. The idea for Apollo 10 and a Half came while Linklater was making Boyhood. That movie, shot over 12 years, and eventually nominated for 5 Golden Globes and 6 Academy Awards in 2015, followed a boy and his family as they changed and developed over more than a decade. Every year, Linklater would write a short vignette based on a year of the boy's life. As he prepared to write the third vignette, the filmmaker thought back to what was happening in his own life at that age. Growing up in Houston during those years felt like living in a real-life science fiction movie, Linklater tells me. Between 1965 and 1969, doctors there performed the nation's first successful heart transplant. Architects built the world's first dome stadium, replete with newfangled artificial grass dubbed AstroTurf. And scientists at NASA were sending men to the moon. It was just unbelievable, he says. Houston felt like the center of everything scientific. Astronauts stepping foot on the surface of the moon united humanity in a way that hasn't really happened since, he says. Looking back now, it seems more like a fleeting final moment of something now lost to us all. This is the last thing that the whole world thought was good, Linklater tells me. It's a few weeks after shooting wrapped on the movie, and he's talking to me in the library he built on his 48-acre ranch in Bastrop, in relative isolation, 30 miles from Austin. Linklater can work on the post-production of Apollo 10.5, as well as a few other projects. Outside his window, birds and crickets chirp and click beneath the afternoon sun. Today, he's working on music cues for the movie. Linklater's films are known to have incredible soundtracks, and while he can't name the songs he's using yet, he assures me they're all era-appropriate. As he talks about the movie, his voice grows more enthusiastic and wistful. Since wrapping the shoot, a pandemic has spread around the globe, and protests have filled the streets. Linklater says he knows the late 60s weren't peace and love for everyone, but watching the Apollo 11 mission as a boy filled him with unbounded optimism. So he's enjoyed the opportunity to escape into a different time. 50 years ago, he says, his voice stretching out the thought, that's a good place to be residing during this time. Linklater was born in 1960 at Herman Hospital in Houston. He lived in the city until he was 7, then his family moved to the suburbs. He was 8 when the Apollo 11 mission landed on the moon. For kids growing up in suburban Houston around then, Linklater recalls, the world was full of indistinct, treeless expanses to ride bikes through, endless housing subdivisions and construction sites to play at, and newly built bowling alleys and movie theaters to escape the heat in. Summer days often meant going to the pool with other kids, cruising through the fog behind the DDD trucks, going to Astroworld, or taking family trips to the coast. Looking back now with a rose-colored lens, the entire setting seems like one big blank slate waiting to be filled in with a child's imagination and fantasy. That's the experience Linklater is trying to capture in the movie. Of course, Houston in 2020 doesn't look like the Houston of 1969. Most neighborhoods have trees now. The Astrodome doesn't look so new. Astroworld has long since closed. Recreating all of that in the real world would cost tens of millions of dollars. So, in 2018, Linklater's Austin-based production company, Detour, put out calls for home movies and archival photos of Houston in the 1960s. They received dozens of replies, with hours of grainy footage of Astroworld, the Astrodome, the young, budding suburbs, and plenty of escapades down to Galveston. Detour is working with Submarine, a production company based in Amsterdam, to fill the background of every shot with modified versions of those old images, as well as the images the production team collected. The result should be a dreamy, nostalgic adventure. It's unlike anything Linklater has ever done before. It's unlike anything anybody has ever done before. This movie won't be the first time Linklater has pushed the boundary of filmmaking. His most personal movies are, in many ways, about the medium itself. He's a renowned fan and scholar of film and film history. A media outlet once asked Linklater to name the 10 movies that influenced him the most, and he returned a list of 250 titles, noting, This is just the beginning. He's also a founding member of the Austin Film Society, a nonprofit for film exhibition and independent filmmaking. Linklater's movies not only question what